Welcome to Thinking Out Loud Expo 67. I'm Monica Kin-Gagnon, and in this episode, I speak to David K. Ross, a Montreal artist and filmmaker whose previous formal training in architecture has brought an interesting visual perspective, quite literally, on Expo 67. The mono, or mini rail, as it was affectionately called, traced a meandering path across the Expo Islands. It was a novel form of transportation, as well as a way of seeing the architecture of the pavilions, an unexpected tour that was also functionally mobile. David's film, As Sovereign as Love, is part of the exhibition In Search of Expo 67, and takes the popularity of the mini rail as its point of departure. You will hear excerpts of the film's narration, which draws from Antoine Saint-Exupéry's Terre des Hommes.
All that I can find in my memory is a few rudimentary notions, fragments of thoughts, direct observations. I cannot compose them into a dramatic recital because there was no drama. The best I can do is to line them up in a kind of chronological order.
My name is David K. Ross, and I'm a visual artist based here in Montreal. I've been here intermittently for the last 10 years or so, and my work oscillates between photography and filmmaking and installation with a kind of inflection and interest in the built world and architecture. I'm trained formally as an architect and then slid into the world of visual arts and photography and filmmaking after that.
You've created an astonishingly beautiful meditation, almost communion with the Expo 67 Islands. And one of the mysterious qualities of the piece, I think, at this stage is the sense of floating with a voiceover that takes us into the past through the text of Saint-Exupéry's Terre des Hommes. I wondered if you could talk about the creation of the work from your perspective.
Sure. Well, I guess it had its genesis in the research I was doing when I was asked to do a project for the exhibition. I turned, like many people, I suppose, to the internet to make some initial inquiries into the site of Expo 67 and how it was sort of manifest and recorded.
Having arrived to build cities on these deserted lands, they built them. A city in their hands became a living thing, to be shaped, to be protected, to be cherished like a child.
A lot of the documentation that I found about Expo 67 was vintage films, basically, that people had made during their visit to the island. You had this situation where you had a bunch of temporary buildings built that were extraordinary in scale and size and scope and design. And you had like millions of people wandering around. You had an elevated rail that moved through these things. And you had on this elevated rail line many hundreds and thousands of people who were armed with this newly released device called the Kodak Super 8 camera. And so when you put those things together, you have the makings of cinema, really. You have a moving camera, you have a cast of thousands, you have buildings that act like sets, basically. And so it occurred to me that that Expo 67 was, if it wasn't a World's Fair, it was actually kind of like a world's film, really, that was made not by one director, but by thousands. It was made not with one cast, but thousands and hundreds of thousands. So thinking about all those things brought me to the realization that I have to make a film about this place. It turns out that the rail line itself was actually borrowed from Lausanne from the previous World's Fair, that the rails or the car and the sort of the mechanism that controlled its operation was all imported directly from the World's Fair that happened in 1964, but that the tracks were all built by a bridge building company here in Montreal. the line was all built here in Montreal. It meant also that all of the engineering drawings were accessible through the Canadian Archives and through the Archives de Montréal. And so I was able to find out exactly, like, meaning within the inch, where each of those pillars and supports were placed on the site that supported the rail line, which meant that I could very accurately map out exactly where that train traveled. And if you look at the in plan, or like from a bird's eye point of view down on the island, the plan of where the train went looks more like a bowl of spaghetti than what you would think of as a normal train route, like, which would be, you know, if you just wanted to move a bunch of people around an island that had a big World's Fair site, you would just make an oval or maybe a diagonal line or something just to get people to A to B. But it had this very sort of meandering path, which was really set up as a kind of optical device in and of itself to provide key views at key moments of key buildings that were on the site. So armed with those kind of details, I basically was able to remap over the island of the contemporary Parc Jean-Drapeau where that rail line went. And using a drone or a camera that's attached to a drone was able to basically retrace the exact path that the train took as it traveled around the island.
The drone footage mm-hmm. is incredible. It creates this sense of floating
mm-hmm.
and also the sense of the impossible points of view that right. one is getting.
This town seemed to be built upon a true humus, a soil one might imagine to be as rich as the wheatlands of the Beauce.
There was a moment early on in the process of the film, I thought, well, all of these original films about the island were made with Super 8 cameras, so maybe I should make my project with a Super 8 camera as well. But I like the idea of anchoring the project really in the contemporary in terms of its image. So that had a lot to do with the decision to use a drone. And, you know, last year at Christmas, apparently in the United States, 475,000 drones were given out as gifts.
Oh,
so
that's frightening.
So it is becoming more so a kind of common way of seeing the world. And I liked the idea that it had a kind of simultaneous democratic and also a little bit creepy, a surveillance aspect to it that it embedded within this kind of imagery are both of those sensibilities. But unlike most, I guess you could call it commercial drone photography, like on television, if you see drone photography, typically they're used quite high up, like at least, mm-hmm. 100 meters up or something like that to give you these broad expansive views of landscape. And the drones are often moving very quickly. They're usually moving forward. And they're usually flying over something like a car, or increasingly drones are used at wedding ceremonies. You have these like images of bride and groom running across open pastoral fields hand in hand where the drone sweeps by and you see the sunset in the distance and stuff. So there's a kind of weird sort of drone porn that exists now. And so I was interested in using the camera in such a way that like really gave you the sense of being on this train. And obviously because the train was elevated for most of its path, it was about it varied in height depending on where it was on the site, between 3 and 7 meters. So if I wanted to really directly retrace the path of this train, it had to be done with a drone. In theory, if I'd done this project 50 years ago and I could have attached a camera to the front of the train, it wouldn't have been a problem, and I could have gotten close to the same kind of footage because I was careful to have the camera move at similar speed as well and slow down at points when there was, for example, when the train stops, it's stopping at places where there were stations, like under the main bridge where the camera stops there. But also, because it's 50 years later, there's things in the way, like trees on the park.
Mm-hmm.
And so those trees or those interruptions act effectively as editing points for the project. And mm-hmm. so you have in this funny way of the island is essentially editing itself. Expo 67 was called Expo 67, but its theme was actually Terre des Hommes, or Man in His World. Mm-hmm. And that title came from, Terre des Hommes came from the title of a book by Saint-Exupéry.
Who knows how or why one visits these gardens ready to hand, habitable for so short a time, a geologic age, for a single day blessed among days.
As I was reading through that book, I realized, much to my kind of amazement, that this book that was written like 80 years ago, he wrote it in between 1936 and 37, and it's a kind of lyrical meditation on what it means to be a pilot. Essentially, he worked as a pilot for Aeropostale, which was the world's first airmail delivery service, and so. During his flights, like, he would actually write while he was flying, which is kind of terrifying. He would sort of take these memoirs, and a lot of his thoughts are expressed in this very poetic and quite beautiful fashion. And he was an unabashed, modernist. Like, he really believed that the technology, like many people of his time and day, really believed that technology was going to make the world a better place. In his case, the airplane was a device for good, that it was only going to improve people's lives, that it was going to, it'll get you a letter from your grandmother in two days, whereas before it took 3 weeks or something. While I was reading this book, I realized there were passages in it that were, while they were descriptions of, say, one of his flights over the Sahara, or passages of what it was like to fly over glaciers in Patagonia, that while they were beautiful descriptions of those places, they also served as uncannily accurate descriptions of the way Parc Jean-Drapeau looks today.
Wow.
So yeah. It was this strange confluence between a kind of desire for what the future was going to hold in terms of Saint-Exupéry's text, as well as the organizers of Expo 67. Like, that project was just like loaded with the idea that progress was a good thing, that the future was only going to be better. And then so we have these views of the park now as it exists today, and it's clearly not the way the park has sort of played out 50 years later. It's not a manifestation of a better world, really. It's a nice park, but it doesn't embody the kind of hopes and aspirations, I don't think, that people were hoping for in 1967. So back to the text, that that essentially what you hear in the film are excerpts from Saint-Exupéry's text as you move through these key locations, and it ends up giving the impression that, I like to think of it, that Saint-Exupéry himself is giving you a guided tour of the park, and so it's like you're sort of hearing this voice from the past overlaid onto the present. Apparently, Simone de Beauvoir said it was the only book that had ever made her dream.
Wow. I wonder if part of that is the point of view, that perspective that's given by Saint-Exupéry, of being in that floating kind of bird's eye point of view,
right,
onto the earth.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Is it's a desire that's been with humans for a long time to fly. So it kind of, to me, it made sense to use his text also to accompany a drone. Like, it's like kind of perfect in that regard, mm-hmm. that you would have a pilot narrating a flight over a park that was also kind of, also like a train ride.
One of the aspects that you've talked about, and that is clear when we think about the monorail or the mini-rail, mm-hmm. is the familiarity of that point of view from the mini-rail. We've seen photographs, original photographs from 1967, and the Super 8 mm-hmm. home movie footage that goes along the train route. And as you said, it's almost like a cast of thousands and a film set that's kind of staged for us. But your current vision, As Sovereign as Love, has this absence and yet this fullness to the image, I think, because of the vegetation and mm-hmm. the trees and the greenness, the lushness of the landscape. I didn't realize that you were trained as an architect. So I think it's your ability to ground us in the current space mm-hmm. while still echoing or having us move through that kind of 50 years ago mm-hmm. Trajectory
right.
is a fascinating part. So now there's a sense of absence, but I wouldn't say loss, mm-hmm. but a sense of the passage of time as nature has somehow taken over
right.
what was this kind of human and artificially inhabited mm-hmm. space for Expo 67 and then Tal des Hommes, of course, afterwards until mm-hmm. the early 1980s.
Yeah, wistfulness is a word that I use a lot to describe it, that you know, wistfulness implies a kind of like longing and looking at the same time for something that was there but isn't anymore. And I mean, I think in the process of making this project, if people would ask me what I was working on and I would tell them, you know, I'm working on this film about Expo 67, the mini rail, blah, blah, blah. Almost without fail, if the person I was talking to was a baby boomer, was born at a point in time where they were old enough to remember attending the fair, I wasn't. I was born a year earlier. So, my memories are only other people's memories, in a sense of it. But for people who were there, there's just this, it's like there's a big electrical power switch that gets like thrown and their eyes glaze over
mm-hmm.
and they go,
I know that
oh
look.
My God, oh, Expo 67. And they just talk about what a wonderful experience it was and how yeah. they fell in love and they kissed their first girl in the train.
Yeah,
and
they smoked pot or had an espresso at the Cuban
yeah,
Pavilion.
Or they made amazing food. There's embedded within how we view Expo 67 now is undoubtedly a sense of a kind of longing for something that existed that is really no longer. And I really think that the way the park exists now is an incredible manifestation of the disparity between the past and the present. Like the reason people get so incredibly worked up about Expo 67 is because it doesn't still exist. You know, mm-hmm. it's because it's a memory.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like Wordsworth described romanticism as like that spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings recollected in tranquility,
mm-hmm.
that there has
That's
to
beautiful.
Be a kind of like initial explosion. But then really to come back to it, you need a period of time passing. You have to go back to your studio. You can go out wandering in the highlands of, you know, in the Peak District, but in order to really make a true record of the experience, you have to be back in your studio or your office and write about it later. And I think that's the point that we're at now as a kind of a collective society, is baby boomers are sitting in their collective studios and thinking back on this thing that happened to them and it's nothing but sunshine and love.
David, thank you very
sure.
much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Join me next week for a conversation with former Expo 67 hostesses who speak from their unique perspectives about how they welcomed the world to Montreal.
This podcast was created and produced by the Thinking Out Loud team at Concordia University. It previews the upcoming exhibition at the Musée d'Art Contemporain de Montréal. Opening June 21st, In Search of Expo 67 will offer visitors new perspectives on some of the most innovative and experimental aspects of the Montreal World's Fair. The exhibition is made possible in part by funding from Concordia's Faculty of Fine Arts and its Office of the Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies. For more Thinking Out Loud, check out our website, concordia.ca/TOL.